ideas of what they might own that does quantum tunneling.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I'm going to say a transistor.
Okay, a transistor sort of can use the concept of quantum tunneling. The primary use for transistors, though, is not exactly that, but it's incredibly close to the answer.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Sometimes when I go to BJ's, I overstock in the refrigerator, and I need quantum tunneling to get the cream cheese out from the back.
Okay, the only problem with that is as you scale up the dimensions, the probability of tunneling to the other side kind of approaches the multiple lifespan of the universe as we know it. So you'd have to wait in front of that refrigerator for a heck of a long time.
I use very little cream cheese.
Okay, well, I guess if you keep it down to a bare minimum, you probably only have to wait a billion or 2 years. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, Roy here, and the question at hand is, do any of you guys know of any piece of equipment, device, what have you, that's probably in everyone's house, many of them, that fundamentally works by the concept of quantum tunneling?
TV set.
Okay, any particular part of the TV set or the TV set as a whole?
I'm guessing the phosphor.
Okay, not really. The phosphor is another interesting aspect of quantum mechanics. It has more to do with disallowed transition zones, so it has to take a much slower route elsewhere to discharge its photons. But it's not quite, as far as I'm aware of tunneling, it isn't the underlying nature of those dyes and such.
WB2KWC.
Okay, I heard Ken, there was another person out there. I can't quite make out their call sign. So if you give it to me a few times, very slowly. Okay, Wesley recognized also, but there was a third guy that was very noisy.
Smoke detectors.
Not really. Smoke detectors use americium, radioactive decay, and the smoke and such is a way of decreasing the ionization count, and so that's really just a weak nuclear force, not really quantum tunneling. Who was first again? Wesley, you're after the next person, but unfortunately my mind. Who is the person other than Wesley who wanted to answer something or ask something or talk?
WB2KWC, Ken.
Oh, okay, Ken. What would you like to say?
Okay, from your description, I'm going to say LCD display screens. And do televisions use phosphors?
Well, old-time televisions obviously used to use phosphorus. The new ones use all kinds of fun stuff, including quantum dots, which also obviously rely on quantum effects. But it wouldn't be LCDs. LCDs work on basically the liquid crystals. They polarize light in different angles when you apply a voltage potential to them, and then using another polarizing media, you can either block or let the light transmit, and by putting different color filters, you can have it red, green, blue, what have you. So not quite tunneling. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, well, carbon nanotechnologies for television displays. They are proceeding to dilution carbon nanotubes and diamonds, and I want to add something to it because phosphor was mentioned. The quantum tunneling process is also said to be much more energy efficient than CRT or an ionized plasma display device. A similar quantum tunneling emission and a phosphor display mechanism is used in SED seed, although the emitter particles used in SED are not carbon. Interesting.
Okay, when Wesley says SED, like everyone knows what SED is, I think he's alluding to a scanning electron microscope. They do use electron tunneling, but although Wesley might own a scanning electron microscope, I don't, and I don't think anyone else out there does. So it's true that it does use the principles of quantum tunneling. I wouldn't call it in everyone's house. And although people are looking into all kinds of aspects of quantum tunneling, there's a whole legion of organic chemists, biochemists, that are trying to figure out if some of the biochemistry that we sort of take for granted, the photosynthesis and metabolism, is augmented biologically through using aspects of quantum tunneling. It's still in the very early stages of the discovery, so no one's really proven anything yet. But these are all just sitting around in the lab room. I'm talking about what's probably next to you, or at least in the room right next to you.
Are you having in mind OLEDs or LEDs?
No. It's very close to the concept of semiconductors. Organic light-emitting diodes work on, obviously, quantum mechanical solid-state natures, but they don't inherently function on a process of tunneling. Now, there is something out there that even has tunneling in its name. It's a component. It's not the answer to this particular puzzle because it's a little on the esoteric side. But there is something called a tunneling diode that is specifically designed to operate based on quantum tunneling. It's used for oscillator circuits and such, but it's a little on the esoteric side. So what I'm looking for is something that pretty much all of you would admit that you have sitting around in devices right now. Okay, has anyone heard of a Zener diode?
Everyone.
Okay, a Zener diode, actually a Zener diode operates on two different principles, which I think is confusing, but nevertheless, the Zener effect, which is why we call it a Zener diode, is actually due to quantum tunneling. What happens is, when you reverse bias a semiconductor, a PN junction, at a certain voltage potential, the electron will tunnel across the boundary, and that's why Zener diodes work. If they didn't work, you wouldn't have that back voltage. Unfortunately, Zener diodes also operate using a different principle entirely, called an avalanche effect, which is not quantum tunneling and usually occurs for Zener diodes with a breakdown, reverse breakdown voltage that's relatively higher. You know, usually voltages of 5.6 and less, they're using the Zener effect, and those over 6 tend to use the avalanche effect. But every Zener diode you own pretty much partially works just because of quantum tunneling. If you turned off quantum tunneling, all those voltage-regulating Zeners would die, and your equipment probably with it.
VDH with a bit of an argument.
And how it stands in comparison to Shorten equations.
Wesley, unfortunately, I stepped on you, so I only heard the second half of that, but John wanted to dispute something, and there's nothing I enjoy better than disputation. So please, John.
Okay, well, since a transistor used in the amplifying configuration operates with the emitter junction forward biased and the collector junction, the collector base junction reverse biased, charges injected by into the emitter junction end up in the collector circuit. So isn't tunneling occurring into the collector junction circuit in normal amplifier operation? Go ahead.
It looks like I'm going to have to look up this stuff again. My understanding, and it's not a thorough investigation by any part, it deals more with narrowing the band of the PN junction rather than tunneling through it. But I'll look it up. I haven't really found any documents because I looked for other examples of quantum tunneling in solid state material, and the only thing I could really come up with was tunneling diodes and Zener diodes. But I'll take a look. The problem is that solid state semiconductors probably kind of manifest all these interesting things in some sometimes obscure ways.
WB2EAZ.
Yes, Ed.
That is an interesting point about the reverse bias base collector junction. Yes, but it's definitely not a quantum effect. It has to do with the energy in the holes in the electrons jumping the gap, but it's not quantum.
Okay, I mean, I hate to kind of break it into a semantic argument. It's definitely, I don't think, quantum tunneling. Quantum effects are kind of, they're all over the place in all kinds of ways. So for the most part, solid-state physics kind of depends. I mean, the whole concept of holes and such it strikes me as a quantum mechanical concept. So I definitely agree with you, although I will look it up once again, that it's not quantum tunneling, but it's probably within the broad field of quantum mechanics. Wesley recognized. I just want to see if Ed has any comments, yay or nay.
BDH would comment.
Okay, John?
Well, the current that starts out in the emitter circuit, pretty much about 98% of it comes out of the collector. That's the alpha, the alpha current gain of the transistor. It's injected into the base, but the base doesn't capture that current. As I say, 98% of that current becomes collector current. IC is alpha IE. So I had thought that was a tunneling effect. And also, I do have a Heathkit tunnel dipper around here somewhere, but I wasn't going to offer that as a solution. But I do have a Heathkit tunnel dipper somewhere. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept because a lot of these times that I talk about quantum mechanics, I think people get the idea that it's kind of blue sky stuff that scientists with white coats are handling. And the idea that we all have voltage regulators that have some use for Zener diodes makes it a little bit more commonplace. So, Wesley, you wanted to say something?
A little person. So say we have a quantum tunneling that we could refer as non-zero probability that the particle in quantum mechanics can be measured to be in state in forbidden in classical mechanics. So a quantum mechanics then occurs because there exists non-trivial solution to Schrodinger equation in a classically forbidden region. And that would correspond to the exponential decay or the magnitude of wave function. But now I have a question for you. How has the Heisenberg uncertainty principle related to quantum tunneling?
Well, offhand, I don't know. A Heisenberg uncertainty principle, unlike some people get measurement error mixed up with the uncertainty principle, holds that because you cannot directly measure both the momentum and the position of any particle. You can measure one or the other, but you can't measure both because of the wave-like aspects of each particle existing in the wave equation of quantum mechanics. But do you have any kind of specific point you want to make about how quantum tunneling is related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle?
Yes, I have. Dr. Roy, pin down the location of the particle by shrinking the walls of the box, which would result the electron wave function acquiring greater momentum, certainly by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. As the box gets smaller and smaller, the probability of measuring the location of the electron, the electron is confined inside the box. I would say the easiest way would be we take the box and make a barrier in the middle of it, sort of very much known debut box. Interesting.
I don't think you could draw the conclusion that Heisenberg uncertainty principle is due to quantum tunneling. You could make a case that the same underlying aspects of defining particles as wave equations with probabilities and such manifest both of these principles. But I don't think A leads to B or B leads to A. I think they both kind of fall out of the concept of only being able to define small particles as probability fields.
Well, I think the easiest solvable example of quantum tunneling is one dimension. Do you agree with that?
Okay, but now you're talking theoretical. Like I said before, a zener diode has three-dimensional quantum tunneling. Tunnel diodes do it. Electron scan microscopes do it. So I don't know if you need to simplify it to one dimension.
Yeah, I know that you're alluding to the tunneling that is responsible for all physical phenomena in three dimensions. That would be what? Radioactive decay, the behavior of semiconductors, superconductors, and scanning tunneling microscopy. I was just saying that the easiest solvable example, if we talk about solvable example, would be one dimension.
Yeah, if you wanted the simplest equation, if you limit it to the simplest manifestation, it's easier to solve. Problem is that it doesn't definitively correlate to normal space-time that we exist in.
Agreed. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. And, of course, Andy, for Andy's Corner, WA2CZL. And everyone who participated, keep in mind that I have link pages, so you can look up the attenuation losses, the velocity factors, some nice articles on ELORAN, bits and pieces of what you've been hearing tonight. You just go to roy.ac2gs.com. And there are links to all of that. And if you need to send me a question or a topic, or you want me to tell Paul to look at something, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at ac2gs.com. And there always is Mike's KC2NJI's website for archives of technical nets going all the way back to 2006. So thanks, everyone. I'll be back at the end, but now it's time for the Space Report with Paul, WS2M.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good on all of us tonight. Good net so far. And, Roy, I sent you a link to one of the topics a couple of minutes ago. So when I get to it, if somebody wants to read it, maybe they'll do a look up your website, and they'll be able to go through it. So, okay, we're in the middle of the summer, and but yet the rockets keep going off worldwide. Not as many right now. This is a bit of a slow period this month for exciting missions. They'll be coming up next month. For instance, right now we have a Delta Heavy that's going to be launched on August 26th, a few days from now, from Cape Canaveral. For the national, the NRO, the it's the government launch for a spy satellite, so, and it's on a heavy vehicle, which means three Delta IVs bolted together, three boosters bolted together with a second stage on top, bringing the NROL 44 to geosynchronous orbit, and that's for the reconnaissance, the National Reconnaissance Office. So that's always an interesting launch because it's such a powerful rocket. That's NASA's strongest rocket right now. They run it on three liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines to get them up there. So it's pretty fiery when it goes off. Interesting launch. And so far as I know, they've all been successful when they've done that. Let me drop it. Now be followed the next day by a Falcon 9 rocket that's going to be taking an Argentina communications satellite also to orbit. And that will be another deal where they try to save the booster and try to save the fairings as they come down in the ocean. This one's a little different. They're going to be launching due south. First time they've done this since the 1960s from Florida. Usually when you go into a polar orbit, this won't be geosynchronous. This is going to be a lower orbit, but in a polar orbit, probably 97 degrees, slightly retrograde. And any of those flights, for like this 50 years have taken off from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, but now SpaceX has the okay to do it from Florida. They go due south, and there's a little bit more land involved over there. There's Cuba and a couple of islands, and they want to make sure that the boosters never accidentally come down and land on somebody. But because SpaceX has developed this internal fail-safe system, which enables the rocket itself to blow up if the computer on board detects that it's going off course, they're now allowed to do that. Previously, before that, the reason we haven't launched polar orbit from Florida is because we had people controlling the process if it needed to happen from ground stations like at Merritt Island, but that's all been replaced to, it's been automated. So, and that's a system that SpaceX is using, for instance, when they bring back two boosters land. You don't have to have a ground station looking at both boosters. They won't have that capability. They would just look at one and blow one up. But now, since they have
this all built into the computer itself on board the rockets. They're allowed to bring back two at once to land at Cape Canaveral. So it's a step in the right direction. Let me drop it. And then that'll be followed by another rocket that will be launched from Kodiak Island in Alaska. This company has been trying to, the name of its Astra, has been trying to launch this rocket that they built. It's going to be their first launch, and they've been delayed for months, you know, like any new rocket system. You know, they're putting up a small payload, that type of a rocket. So it's not a heavy lift vehicle, not a medium, but, you know, a couple hundred pounds. They plan on doing this on a regular basis if they can ever prove out their this one particular rocket. So that should be going up probably the end of August, late August. So let me just drop it and we'll move on. Like I said before, they have more important launches coming up at the end of this month into next month. You know, you have a Cygnus Antares rocket. Cygnus is a cargo vehicle. Antares is a launch vehicle built by now Northrop Grumman. It used to be Orbital ATK, and that's going to launch out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. They've done this many times before, but it's always pretty good, depending on the time of day that it goes up. It's whether the weather's clear or not. It's possible to see the rocket, the light from the rocket, the engine. They have Russian engines on this particular rocket that the United States buys from them, RD-181s, and you can see the light from that low in the horizon if you look northwest from Long Island. At the time of launch, around a minute and a half after launch. So that's a cargo vehicle resupplying the International Space Station. So that'll be one important launch. And another launch comes up soon after that, which would be from Russia. From Kazakhstan. The Russians launched the Soyuz vehicle. This will have a crew on board. Three-person crew, a couple of Russians and an American from NASA, Dr. Kate Rubin, and she's a ham. Kate in mid-October to the International Space Station. I know we have now the Dragon vehicle capable of sending our own people up. But we still have contracts with Russia, and just continue to do that. I don't know how long they're going to keep that up. Maybe indefinitely as a backup. And as time goes on, the Russians will probably be invited to fly on an American Dragon SpaceX rocket. Right now, the Russians said, "No way. We want to make sure that this rocket, that the Dragon, is safe." But in the future, I can see that happening. They used to do that with the space shuttle as well. We've had Russians go up on the space shuttle. Let me drop it. So she'll be going up, and then she'll be joining Chris Cassidy, and he'll be coming down the next week. Chris Cassidy, another ham, KF-5 KDR, will be returning from space after a six-month tour on the space station with the two Russians that he went up with. Right now, it's a three-person crew up there. When Kate goes up there with the two Russians from Kazakhstan, you'll be up to six for about a week, and then they'll bring back Chris and the other two guys, and they'll be back to three. But that won't last. The other flight toward the end of October will presently scheduled is going to be on a SpaceX Dragon vehicle with four people at one time for. You're going to have three people from NASA. Correction, you have all three from NASA, and you're going to have one from Japan. all flying on the same rocket to the space station. And you're gonna bring up all these four people I've mentioned. I think last week and the week before are experienced. They've all flown before. Sharon Walker, another ham, KD5DXB with Michael Hopkins, KF5LJG, and Victor Grover, K15BKC, along with the other fellow from Japan, Sashi Nogachiya. He's KD5TVP, and they'll be up there for 6 months. But what's interesting is that will be a seven-person crew, and this has been the goal all along to try to, the last couple of years, to try to get it up to a seven-person crew. And why do they want to do that? To sell the repeater ID. And it was, you know, the reason for that is right now you have a lot of maintenance that goes on the ISS. So who's ever up there? If it's a three-person crew, or the last few years it's been a six-person crew. When it was a six-person crew, they figured out that there's so much work that's done on the space station that they were really only getting about 35 hours of actual science time collectively from the crew of six. And the rest of the time is spent maintaining the space station to some degree. Not that that's the only science that's being done. There's 400 experiments going on, usually at one time. The hands-on ones that you need astronauts for is roughly 35 hours. There's other scientific things that are going on from being controlled from mission control in Houston or JPL or even some of the other countries, like Germany has a mission control, and they'll control certain science experiments from their different locations. So there's a lot more hours than the 35 hours. But the 35 hours for, you know, hands-on type of operations is really all you get. This will double that number by having a seventh person up there, because that's, you figure it this way, that the station is being maintained, all the spacewalks and everything that has to be done on a regular basis by that same six-person crew. This guy's coming up there. All his hours will be dedicated to science. Not specifically him. He'll help maintain the station too, but when you average everything out, that's what it comes out to. So they'll be doubling their science that comes back from the space station for years to come, as long as they can keep the seven-person crew in place. So I think that's pretty good. And not only that, we'll have a lot of contacts with probably schools, and I know they're doing things virtually now, but eventually maybe you're going to have a situation where you're going to have a school that is, you know, open, and like what we're going to have here in New York, that might be able to contact the space station. You might have a group of people in one school, maybe in a big auditorium, separated by 6 feet apart or something. I can see that happening within maybe 6 months or a year, hopefully. Anyway, we'll go on if nobody has any questions. This is WS2N.
62 Bravo Zulu.
Hi, Rich. You're a little low, but go ahead. Back to you.
A little low. I was wondering why, with all the mind-boggling sophistication of putting one of these pieces of metal up in orbit, why clouds that any private pilot, kid learning how to fly by instrument flight rules, can fly through clouds and the space shuttle can't? What's the ultimate reason?
Okay, well, of course, the space shuttle is now does not fly anymore, but when, you know, they retired it in 2011, they need to have an abort situation. Don't forget, if you're flying in an airplane, there's fuel on board, and you know, you might decide to come down for a landing. The weather might be getting bad, but you're going to come down. And as you come down, you look at the runway, and you're a little off. And you say, well, you know, abort. And you just gun it and make another pass and come down again. And, you know, sooner or later, you're going to have a situation where you could land. Or if the weather gets worse, they might say, you know, go to Teterboro or something, fly somewhere else. And land. The space shuttle couldn't do that. You know, it had plenty of fuel for a launch. But if there was any reason to abort, and if there were clouds and storms, and you know, you could get hit with lightning and throw all your instruments out of whack. For instance, that happened with Apollo 12, the second crew to go to the moon. They got hit with lightning. They managed to, you know, get by, you know, they fixed it on the way uphill, and they eventually got to the moon. But, you know, something could happen, and they need to abort. And if they're going to abort back to KFC, they have a 3-mile runway there. And they need to, when they come down, they're going to be a glider. They're not going to be using those RS-25. Three engines in the back of the shuttle to land. But they're just going to come back and land as a glider. They come down at 200 some odd miles an hour, and they won't have a second chance. So if there's a storm nearby or a cloud or, you know, some reason to, like that, that's going to be one of the reasons to cancel. You know, and then they had other... Madrid, Spain, had a runway.
Paul, WB2EAV.
WB2EAV, go ahead.
For the launch, the reason they wanted clear weather is for the optical telescoping and filming and tracking and all that kind of stuff. And also, if they should have to abort and come down, you need good visibility. For the landing, the space shuttle, it was a dead stick landing. You got one shot, and its flying characteristics were not much better than that of a prick.
Okay, yeah, that's trying to explain. You know, but you can go make another pass. This thing, there's no second chance that you're coming down, and that's it. You don't have enough. You don't have. There's no fuel on board. Well, there's plenty of fuel, but you can't light the engines to make another pass. And they had other reports too, so they had to consider what's the weather in, for instance, Madrid, Spain. If they went up, certain engines failed, or an APU. And they had to abort before they got to orbit, and they had to land in Spain. Well, before launch, they had to make sure not only was the weather good in Florida, they need the weather to be good in Spain and a couple of the other places as well. So, yeah, that's the story on that. Let me go back to WB2BZ. Back to you, Richard.
Yeah, I was actually using the space shuttle generically. I guess it's way, way different now with what they're doing presently, but I was just using it generically where, you know, they're not flying it, you know, dead sticking it with as a glider where you only have one shot. I was doing it... you know, even now, the spaceships that are going up now, how bad does it have to get? I mean, it can't be just clouds that'll stop a mission, right? What do they lose? I wonder, do you know how much, on the average, they lose per aborted mission? It must be millions and millions of dollars that they lose. So, so it would have to be clouds, but also lightning and some other good stuff, huh?
Yeah, they have flight rules. I think lightning is 30 miles away. if lightning's within 30 miles, they're no good. I think winds, I'm going back with the shuttle, it's probably the same now with Dragon and eventually with Boeing's Starliner, that's going to carry a crew as well. And you're going to have, I think 30 mile an hour winds or something like that is out. So, you know, there's a lot of constraints on these flights. And again, they have a similar kind of problem. They're not going to land on a runway, but they've got to be able to come down and land in good seas. So, you know, if you have rough weather and out in the Atlantic, they're going to call the flight. If you abort, I mean, you could abort right from the launch pad. You know, you could have a situation where the booster blows up. If that happens, the spacecraft itself automatically disconnects and takes off, and goes about, I think, around 5 miles out, up and a couple miles out to sea, and then lands in the water, and they come by and pick them up. So all that is taken into consideration. So, okay, let me just continue on here, unless you have any other questions on this topic. This is WS2N.
No, that's it. Thanks, Paul.
Very good, Rich. Yeah, okay. Another topic that, you know, we talked about on the net for years, I remember with Dick, was the building of the space station itself. You know, when is it going to be complete, and is it complete? And there's always things that we're going to add. But they got to the point in the last couple of years, they really haven't added much. You know, they added the alpha magnetic spectrometer. You know, that's a pretty big unit on top of the one of the truss units that was brought up by SpaceX. But not too many big modules. SpaceX brought up the beam. The Bigelow excursion module, the inflatable module that's now attached to the space station, was going to stay attached for 2 years. They were going to disconnect it and get rid of it, but it proved that it's worth it. It's 100% solid, so they kept that on board. But the space station, you know, always had plans of still having a few more improvements. The Russians wanted to send up a large module. I think it was like 30 feet long, and I believe it was like 14 feet in diameter. It would have been their largest module, and it was called Nukia, N-A-U-K-A, Nukia. Russian piece that never went up. And now that is planned on going up in April, coming up a few months from now. So the space station is not complete. So how they're going to get that up there is with a Proton rocket from Russia. And it's been delayed. This thing should have been, you know, it was being built 12 years ago. And they've had all kinds of problems with it. All kinds of delays. Because of the delays, the plumbing and the piping all had to be changed out because it went past its expiration date. You know, because they had fueled it, and they were worried about things rotting out. So, I mean, everything changed out on this thing. But it's designed, it was designed after the first segment that went up, which is still attached to the space station. Called the FAB, it's the functioning cargo block, Zarya. Zarya was, you know, propulsion control, had everything, and that eventually attached to one of our modules, you know, Unity module, and that was the beginning back in 1999, and eventually we got to the point where we could put a crew on board. We've had a crew on board for 20 years, since 2000, now it's 2020. So, but this original module is still there, and this is really a backup in case that thing failed or the Proton rocket that sent it up from Russia went into the drink or something. They would have had a backup, but they converted it into another module where it's going to be able to sleep another person, have another bathroom on board. It's a science laboratory. You know, we've had our science laboratory up there for literally decades now, called Destiny, and European Space Station. The European Space Agency has theirs called Columbus. Japan has theirs, the biggest one right now on board station called Kaibo from Japan. The Russians had two smaller ones attached to the space station. The Piers and the Razvet module. But, you know, it wasn't very big, and in fact, the Russians were even cutting back to their crew of two instead of three because they couldn't really handle what they had. Bring their group up to a steady three anyway for the Russians instead of cutting back to two. If they get this thing up there and one of the modules. Right now there's four ways of docking to the space station. One is the Zvezda, the main module for the Russians, and then there's three others called Piers, Razvet, and Poiz. Razvet and Poiz are the two science ones, but they're also docking ones. But then there's the Piers. Piers is the earliest one. It's facing down toward Earth. And yeah, there is a down and an up on the International Space Station, and there's a left and a right, a starboard and a port. And the Piers are going to disconnect that. I think with this flight, there's a Progress ship attached to it. And Progress, you know, Russian vehicle is going to disconnect the Piers and then deorbit both of them. They'll burn up over the South Pacific. And that'll leave that one port open. And then the Proton rocket will be able to bring up Nuclear and attach that. And so that will be expanding. And that to be outdone, NASA's given a contract out to this other company called Axiom. Axiom is building a module that will attach to the front of the International Space Station right now. Right now you come out with the very front is Harmony, a module called Harmony. It's a node. And then in front of that is the docking port, pressure mating adapter number two, that's attached to that. And they plan on bringing that forward and putting another big module in front by Axiom, and they actually plan to at least two more modules to be attached in the future. And the goal of Axiom is to attach all these modules, three or four of them, you know, with more solar panels and everything. And someday, that in case NASA decides to start deorbiting everything, they plan on separating this whole group of Axiom modules from the space station and become a private space station. So, I mean, it's long term, might never happen, but they are, you know, these are plans for the space station in the not only in the near future but distant future. This is WS2N.
Anybody see my giraffe?
Okay, so anyway, there's one topic I wanted to talk about, but I'm not, I probably can, maybe I can get to it. Let's see, let me discuss the current. They're looking for a small leak on the International Space Station. They plan on, you know, what happened was back in September, NASA noticed that the pressure was dropping a little bit, not dangerously so, but very little bit, and they're trying to locate where is this leak. So what they're going to do is, right now actually they're doing it, there's three people on board like I mentioned earlier. They're going to all isolate themselves into the Russian side of the space station. and then start closing off all the doors. There's like 20 doors on the International Space Station. There's so many modules. So they'll close off all the doors, and they'll try to figure out where the leak is. NASA will go through all the telemetry that comes back and try to actually locate where this leak is. You know, they'll go step at a time, and if they do, they'll try to make a plan to try to fix it. There's an acceptable leak, and that's acceptable on the space station. You know, it's not 100%, but it's close to it. And then, of course, when they do EVAs or spacecraft come by, and cargo vehicles attach or detach, you know, there's always a loss here and there. That's acceptable. But there's also this other slight leak that's going on that they're going to try to control. So that's presently being done right now. Let me just drop it for a second. Okay, this other topic I was going to cover, but I'm going to run out of time. It's a little too long anyway. It has to do with astronauts giving their advice to people dealing with isolation from the COVID virus. And what they did is they got a hold of three astronauts that have spent a lot of time in space. For instance, they got a hold of Peggy Whitson, and she spent three different flights to the International Space Station. She flew once on Space Shuttle Endeavour, twice on the Soyuz rocket, and then back in 2017. Broke a record for the amount of days for the United States, 665 days in space, you know, collectively from all these flights. So she knows something about isolation, and she was giving out advice on what people should do on Earth. So, you know, she says it's very important to interact with people that you're staying with, living with. She went on to compare current situation with COVID-19 to how astronauts live on board the space station. Different tips. A lot of people are trying to work from home, trying to, you know, be parents and trying to do everything. And so it becomes very challenging. So there's a whole bunch of advice that she does give, but I won't be able to go through it all. But what I did is I sent it over to Roy's website. You can click on it. It's actually from space.com, you know, you'd be able to read the whole thing. Scott Kelly was another one. He's an astronaut from the United States. He has a brother, Mark Kelly. They're both astronauts, and they're presently both retired. But Scott Kelly spent a solid year, in space a couple of years ago. Plus, he had a couple of other missions. Scott didn't have an amateur radio license, but Peggy did. She let hers expire. But they were able to not only talk to their families directly, not through ham radio, but directly through NASA to keep in contact. And that's what they recommend people on Earth to do, is to contact all your relatives and friends and go on and on and talk to them about, you know, what's going on. And that's the way to keep yourself, you know, from not going nuts, sitting in a house isolated too much. And there's he gives a lot of advice in the article. And then there's Chris Hadfield. He comes out of Canada. He actually has two active call signs up in Canada. He has VA-300G, VA-300G. And then you have his call letter from the States. Because they're always stationed down in Texas, this is how they get their call letters. And they always have five call letters, number five in their call letter. And he's KC5RNJ. And he gives a bunch of advice. He's the guy that went up to space and bought a guitar with him and played a guitar from space. And he gives a lot of very good advice. He has a video on that website. You can click on it, and he talks about, you know, it's not long, a couple of, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes, no more than that. And he talks about isolation and what people should be doing on Earth. And they compare it to orbit. So it's pretty good. Let me drop it. The link for the URL over to Roy. Roy.ac2gs.com. You can bring that up. And there's a couple other topics I can get to next week. I've been holding up long enough here for a while. Let me just send it back to let's see if anybody has any questions first, questions or comments for the net.
AC2LR, quick question.
Okay, hi Jay, how you doing? Over to you.
Can you repeat the dates and time of that launch where you said we would be able to see it from Long Island looking northwest?
Oh, okay, yeah, you're talking about the mission. Yeah, I've done this before. So I've seen it once. I know a couple of people that have seen it more than once. That would be presently scheduled for October 14th, naturally. September 29th. That's September 29th, the end of this month. And, of course, the weather always, or something technical, it could be delayed. But presently, that would be it. I don't have the time. I guess they'll probably release the time at a later date. But, I'll find out the time for next week. But, there's a website I go for that. So, Cygnus and Antares. You have to, it's naturally, if you can get near the water, you're better off with a southwesterly view from Long Island or even the city. They said some people went up to the top of the buildings in the city, and they were able to see a couple of them when they went up. I think they're up to about the 13th flight now over the years. Back to you, Ken.
Thank you very much. I'm looking up information on the launch right now. Back to you.
It'll take me a minute. I could find it as well. But, what I worry about is, giving that time to then the next thing you know, they change it on you. And that happens a lot. So let's see if my tablet works here. There we go. Let's see. We got September. End of September, right? Let's see. Antares, okay. Yeah, they're showing 10. Let me go with Eastern Time. 10:26 Eastern Time PM. So nighttime, you'll be able to see this one good. But you could even see it if it's a daytime launch. It's not like some of these things you have to wait for the sunrise or sunset. The sun reflecting off of it. These are the actual the light from the engine. So that's why it could be seen in the daytime. But this is a nighttime launch. 10:26, so that should be pretty good, Kate. Back to you.
Got it. Thank you. This is AC2LR. Back to you.
Okay, any other comments, questions, before we turn it over to Roy? I guess not. This has been the SpaceNet report for the TechNet, and we'll be here again next week. And you get a chance tomorrow night, they have the Club InfoNet, and that's at 8:30, and it's repeated, followed by the Swap and Shop. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks for the space report. Thanks to Andy for Andy's Corner. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and thanks even to the people who quietly just listened along. You know, as I always say, this net is a process, is the sum total of the people participating, the questions asked, the insights added by other people, and I thank you all for that. As I always do, I remind people that if you have a question and you can't get onto the net, or if you would like a topic discussed, or if you would like me to pass along a message to Paul,